The hypothalamus, a small almond-sized structure in the brain, plays a surprisingly large role in our bodies.
It's like a tiny command center, right? I've heard it called the link between the nervous system and the endocrine system.
Exactly. It's constantly monitoring and adjusting things, keeping everything in balance. That's homeostasis, by the way.
Right, homeostasis. So how does it manage all of that?
Well, one of its main partners in crime is the pituitary gland. Think of them as a dynamic duo.
The pituitary gland, that's the master gland, isn't it?
It's often called that, but it's more accurate to think of the hypothalamus as the real master, pulling the strings, so to speak. The pituitary gland carries out a lot of the hypothalamus's directives.
Oh, so tell me about the pituitary gland then. What's the deal with the anterior and posterior lobes?
Good question. They have different origins and functions. The posterior pituitary is actually an extension of the hypothalamus itself, neural tissue. It stores and releases hormones made by the hypothalamus like oxytocin and vasopressin.
Oxytocin, that's the love hormone, right? And vasopressin, isn't that related to blood pressure?
You got it. Oxytocin is involved in social bonding, childbirth, and lactation. Vasopressin, also known as antidiuretic hormone or ADH, helps regulate water balance and blood pressure.
I see. Interesting. So what about the anterior pituitary?
The anterior pituitary is a bit more independent. It develops from glandular tissue, not neural tissue like the posterior pituitary. It produces and secretes its own hormones, but their release is still controlled by the hypothalamus.
So the hypothalamus is still in charge, even though the anterior pituitary makes its own hormones?
Precisely. The hypothalamus uses releasing and inhibiting hormones to tell the anterior pituitary what to do. It's a complex system of signals and feedback loops.
So what kind of hormones does the anterior pituitary produce?
A whole bunch. Growth hormone, prolactin, thyroid-stimulating hormone, adrenocorticotropic hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone.
Wow, that's a lot. What do all of those do?
Well, as you might guess, growth hormone is essential for growth and development. Prolactin is involved in milk production. Thyroid-stimulating hormone regulates the thyroid gland, which controls metabolism. Adrenocorticotropic hormone acts on the adrenal glands, important for the stress response. And follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone regulate the reproductive system.
So the hypothalamus and pituitary gland are really essential for a huge range of bodily functions.
Absolutely. Everything from growth and reproduction to metabolism, stress response, and even sleep-wake cycles. And the way they work together, this intricate dance of hormones and feedback loops, is just fascinating.
It really is. And it's amazing how such a small part of the brain can have such a big impact on the whole body. So what happens if something goes wrong with this system?
Well, a lot can go wrong, actually. Tumors, for example, can disrupt hormone production, leading to a variety of conditions. Too much growth hormone can cause gigantism or acromegaly, while too little can lead to growth problems. Problems with ADH can cause diabetes insipidus, and there are many other potential issues.
It sounds like a delicate balance.
It is, but it's also remarkably robust, capable of adapting to a wide range of challenges. The hypothalamus receives input from all over the body and the environment, allowing it to fine-tune its responses and maintain homeostasis. It's truly a remarkable system.
It sounds like there's still a lot to learn about how the hypothalamus works.
Oh, definitely. It's a complex area of research, but we're learning more all the time. For example, recent research has shown that the hypothalamus is involved in fear processing and even plays a role in learning. It's not just about basic functions like hunger and thirst. It's also involved in higher-level cognitive processes.
That's really interesting. So it's not just a simple thermostat, but more like a sophisticated computer, integrating information from all over the body and making decisions about how to respond.
Exactly. And it's constantly learning and adapting, which is what makes it so fascinating to study.
It makes you appreciate the incredible complexity of the human brain, doesn't it? So much going on in such a small space.
So we've been talking about the hypothalamus, this tiny but powerful control center in the brain, and its close relationship with the pituitary gland.
Yeah, and how the pituitary gland, often called the master gland, is actually more like a middle manager, taking directions from the hypothalamus.
Exactly. And the pituitary itself is a fascinating structure, divided into the anterior and posterior lobes, each with distinct functions.
Right. The posterior pituitary stores and releases hormones made by the hypothalamus, like oxytocin and ADH, or vasopressin.
Important hormones. Oxytocin, sometimes called the love hormone, is involved in social bonding, childbirth, and lactation, while ADH helps regulate water balance, crucial for maintaining stable blood pressure and hydration. It basically tells your kidneys to hold on to water.
Okay, so the posterior pituitary is like a storage unit for hormones made upstairs in the hypothalamus. What about the anterior pituitary?
The anterior pituitary is more of a manufacturing plant. It produces its own hormones, but their release is still controlled by the hypothalamus, using, releasing, and inhibiting hormones like a complex system of signals and feedback loops.
So it's like the hypothalamus sends down orders for specific hormone production?
Precisely. And the anterior pituitary produces a whole array of hormones, each with specific targets and effects.
Like what? We talked about growth hormone, prolactin.
Right. Growth hormone, essential for, well, growth and development. Prolactin, vital for milk production. Then there's thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH, which, as the name suggests, stimulates the thyroid gland to produce its own hormones that regulate metabolism.
And there's ACTH, right? Adrenal corticotropic hormone?
Yes, ACTH acts on the adrenal glands, stimulating the release of cortisol, our primary stress hormone. It's part of that complex hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis, which is crucial for our response to stress.
So the hypothalamus is really pulling the strings, orchestrating this whole hormonal symphony?
Absolutely. And then we have the gonadotropins, follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH, and luteinizing hormone, LH, which are essential for reproductive function in both males and females. They act on the gonads, stimulating the production of sex hormones and the development of sperm and eggs.
It's amazing how much these two tiny structures control. So this system with the hypothalamus and pituitary working together, can it go wrong?
Oh, definitely. There are a number of things that can disrupt this delicate balance. Tumors, for instance, can lead to an overproduction or underproduction of certain hormones, causing a cascade of problems.
Problems like?
Well, too much growth hormone can lead to gigantism or acromegaly, while too little can cause growth problems. Issues with ADH can result in diabetes insipidus, a condition where the kidneys can't conserve water, and there are many other potential issues depending on which hormone is affected.
It really emphasizes how crucial this system is for overall health. And the development of the pituitary, it sounds pretty complex.
It is. It involves a delicate dance of embryonic tissues, with the anterior pituitary developing from an outpocketing of the oral cavity and the posterior pituitary developing from an extension of the brain. It's a fascinating process.
And if something goes wrong during development?
It can lead to a variety of congenital abnormalities affecting hormone production and overall function. But, you know, despite its complexity, the pituitary is also remarkably resilient, capable of adapting to a wide range of challenges.
It really is an incredible system. So much complexity packed into such a small space, controlling so many essential functions, it makes you appreciate the intricate workings of the human body, doesn't it?
So we've been delving into the intricacies of the hypothalamus and pituitary gland, this remarkable command center in the brain.
Yeah, it's fascinating how these tiny structures wield such immense control over our bodies. So, picking up on the pituitary gland, what happens if its development goes awry?
Well, during embryonic development, the pituitary forms from two distinct tissues, the anterior pituitary from an outpocketing of the oral cavity, and the posterior from brain tissue. If anything disrupts this delicate process, it can lead to congenital abnormalities.
Meaning?
Meaning the pituitary might not function correctly, leading to hormonal imbalances from birth. These can affect growth, metabolism, and even cognitive function.
Wow. It's a testament to how precisely orchestrated development needs to be. And speaking of growth, we talked about growth hormone, but what are its other effects besides, you know, growth?
Right. Growth hormone isn't just for growth. It plays a crucial role in protein synthesis, tissue repair, and even blood sugar regulation. Devesa et al. 2014 delve into this, highlighting its multiple roles throughout the body.
So it's a multitasker, like a hormonal Swiss Army knife.
Exactly. And then there's prolactin, which we mentioned in the context of lactation, but Pereira Suarez et al. 2014 discuss its role in the inflammatory response, which is pretty interesting.
Oh, so it's not just about milk production?
Nope. It's involved in the body's defense mechanisms, too. And then there's oxytocin, often dubbed the love hormone, but its functions extend far beyond social bonding. Parmo and Malik, 2017, provide a great overview of its various roles, from childbirth to, well, love.
It's amazing how much we're still learning about these hormones. And what about ADH or vasopressin? We discussed its role in water balance, but is there more to it?
Definitely. Hanbei et al. 2019 explored its connection to serum osmolarity and related outcomes, revealing a deeper understanding of its physiological impact. It's not just about hydration, it's about maintaining a delicate balance of fluids and electrolytes.
It seems like every time we peel back a layer, there's another layer of complexity underneath. And ACTH, the stress hormone.
Ah yes, ACTH Gallup-Payette 2016 highlighted its adrenal and extra-adrenal functions. It's involved in far more than just the stress response.
So the stress response itself is more intricate than we might think.
Absolutely. Kondalou 2012 discussed cortisol's effects on both physical and psychological aspects of the body, emphasizing the interconnectedness of our hormonal and mental states. And if something goes wrong with ADH regulation, you can end up with diabetes insipidus.
Which is different from the other diabetes, right?
Exactly. Caldera et al. 2016 clarified this distinction, explaining how diabetes insipidus is related to ADH deficiency, while the more common forms of diabetes involve insulin and blood sugar regulation. The Pituitary Foundation also has some excellent resources on this.
It's good to have those resources available. And TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone?
Fitzgerald and Bean, 2018, explored how TSH autoregulates, reducing variations in response to thyroid hormones. It's a fascinating feedback mechanism that helps keep our metabolism in check. And the hypothalamus itself, Saper and Local, 2014, provided a comprehensive overview of its structure and function, highlighting its role in everything from basic bodily functions to higher-level cognitive processes.
It's mind-boggling how much this tiny area controls. And pituitary hyperplasia, what's that?
Well, the Souza SMC et al. 2015 described it as an under-recognized and heterogeneous condition, where the pituitary gland becomes enlarged. It can lead to a range of hormonal imbalances depending on the underlying cause.
It really underscores the importance of understanding these intricate hormonal pathways and the delicate balance they maintain. It's truly a remarkable system, isn't it?
So, we've been discussing the impact of stress on the brain, and it's clear that social connections play a surprisingly significant role.
Yeah, this buffering theory, right, where close relationships provide emotional support that helps people cope with chronic stress and crises.
Exactly. It's like having a safety net, and it's fascinating how this translates to the neurobiological level.
So how does it translate? What's going on in the brain?
Well, McEwen et al. 2015 highlight the brain's remarkable plasticity in response to stress. It's not just a passive recipient, but actively remodels itself, for better or worse.
Remodels? You mean physically changes?
Precisely. Dendrites, the branching extensions of neurons, can shrink or expand. Synapses, the connections between neurons, can be lost or gained. Even neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons, can be suppressed.
Wow. So stress can actually reshape the brain's architecture?
It can. And these changes can be adaptive, a sign of successful coping, or maladaptive, a sign of failed resilience. It's this delicate balance between allostasis, the process of adaptation, and allostatic load, the wear and tear from chronic stress.
So like good stress versus toxic stress?
Exactly. And early life experiences, particularly those involving abuse or neglect, can have a lasting impact on how the brain responds to stress later in life. This biological embedding can make individuals more vulnerable to toxic stress.
It's like setting the stage for how the brain will react to future challenges.
Precisely. And key players in this remodeling process are glucocorticoids like cortisol and excitatory amino acids like glutamate. They act on specific brain regions like the hippocampus, amygdala, and prefrontal cortex, each with a distinct roles in stress response and behavior.
So different parts of the brain are affected differently by stress?
Yes. For instance, chronic stress can cause dendritic shrinkage in the hippocampus, affecting memory, while in the amygdala, it can lead to dendritic expansion, increasing anxiety. And in the prefrontal cortex, the effects vary depending on the subregion, impacting cognitive flexibility and decision-making.
It's like a domino effect, with stress triggering a cascade of changes throughout the brain?
Exactly. And these changes are mediated by a complex interplay of molecules, including BDNF, CRF, endocannabinoids, and TPA, each with its own role in shaping the brain's response to stress. It's not a simple on/off switch, but a complex network of interactions.
So it's not just about the stress itself, but how the brain interprets and reacts to it at a molecular level.
Precisely. And this is where epigenetic mechanisms come into play. Stress can alter gene expression through histone modifications, DNA methylation, and even the activity of retrotransposons, these jumping genes that can affect genomic stability.
So stress can actually change how our genes are expressed, even without changing the DNA sequence itself?
Exactly. And these epigenetic changes can be long-lasting, influencing how the brain responds to future stressors. It's like a molecular memory of past experiences.
So our experiences, especially early in life, can shape not just our minds, but the very structure and function of our brains at a molecular level. That's pretty profound.
So we've been talking about how stress can actually reshape the brain, right, down to the cellular level.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, like dendrites shrinking and expanding, synapses disappearing.
Exactly. And even neurogenesis, the birth of new brain cells, can be affected. It's not just a metaphorical change, but a physical one.
So what are the key players in this remodeling process?
Well, molecules like glucocorticoids, you know, cortisol, and excitatory amino acids like glutamate, they act on specific brain regions.
Like the hippocampus, the amygdala.
Right, and the prefrontal cortex. Each area plays a different role in the stress response, so the effects of stress aren't uniform across the brain.
So chronic stress could shrink dendrites in the hippocampus, affecting memory, but expand them in the amygdala, increasing anxiety?
Precisely. It's a complex interplay, with different regions responding in different ways. And it's not just these larger structures. Even things like cell adhesion molecules are involved.
Cell adhesion molecules? What do they have to do with stress?
Well, take PSA and CAM, for example. It's involved in facilitating plasticity in the hippocampus. Studies have shown that removing it can actually make neurons more vulnerable to damage from stress.
Oh, so it's like a double-edged sword. It promotes plasticity, but also limits excessive growth, which could be protective.
Exactly. And there are other cell adhesion molecules like neurologins and NECTIN3 that are also affected by chronic stress, with consequences for social behavior and even cognitive function.
It's like a delicate ecosystem with all these different molecules interacting and influencing each other?
Precisely. And then there's the cytoskeleton, the internal scaffolding of the neuron. It plays a crucial role in dendritic remodeling.
So how does that work?
Well, studies of hibernating animals have shown that dendritic retraction during hibernation is accompanied by changes in tau, a protein associated with the cytoskeleton. It suggests that changes in the cytoskeleton might allow dendrites to shrink and potentially protect neurons from damage.
So it's like a controlled dismantling and reassembly process?
Yeah. And it's not just structural proteins, even proteins involved in the cell nucleus, like NUP62, play a role in stress-induced dendritic remodeling. It highlights the interconnectedness of all these different cellular processes.
Mm. Hmm. It's fascinating how much is going on inside these tiny cells. And then there's the epigenetic aspect, right? How stress can actually change gene expression.
Exactly. Things like histone modifications and DNA methylation, these changes can be long-lasting, influencing how the brain responds to future stressors. It's like a molecular memory of past experiences.
So our experiences, especially early in life, can shape not just our minds, but the very structure and function of our brains at a molecular level. It's like a feedback loop between our genes and our environment.
Precisely. And this brings us to the idea that stress isn't just one thing. It's a complex interplay of different mediators. And the timing of these mediators is crucial. Circadian rhythms, for example, play a huge role.
So like when we experience stress matters just as much as how much stress we experience?
Exactly. Disruptions to our circadian rhythms can actually mirror the effects of chronic stress, leading to metabolic changes and even remodeling of neurons in the prefrontal cortex.
It's like throwing a wrench in the gears of the whole system.
Exactly. And all of this underscores the importance of resilience. The brain's ability to adapt and recover from stress is essential for maintaining mental and physical health.
So it's not just about avoiding stress, but about building up our capacity to cope with it?
Precisely. And that's where things like behavioral therapies and targeted treatments that promote plasticity can be incredibly helpful. They can help the brain relearn how to adapt and recover from stress.
It's a message of hope, really, that even though stress can have profound effects on the brain, we're not powerless against it. We can learn to be more resilient, to bounce back from challenges, and to build stronger, healthier brains. Thanks for joining us for this episode of R, where we hope you found this conversation insightful, and we look forward to seeing you next time.